This is 88.1 WYPR, Baltimore's NPR news station. Community amplified.
I'm tired of the same people running for office. They probably have no idea what it's like for somebody to buy a house, somebody send their kid to daycare. I would vote for those young people just to get a change.
What changed and what stayed the same this election? I'm News Director Matt Bush, and this is WYPR's News Roundup. Today, we dive into Maryland's election results from Baltimore to the western and southern tips of Maryland, plus Sail 250. As Baltimore starts celebrating the U.S. at 250, protesters plan a march in Washington, D.C., and we finish Pride Month with a party.
Everybody calls it Butch Gardens, but I refuse to change it. It's Butch Garden.
That's all coming up. And good afternoon, and welcome to the WYPR News Roundup. I'm Matt Bush, news director of the award-winning WYPR Newsroom. This week, we'll look at Sail 250, which is busy crowding up the Inner Harbor with boats, people, and all those noisy jets in the sky. Then later, we'll close out Pride Month with a trip to Butch Garden, one family-friendly Baltimore party that started years before this Pride Month and pledges to continue long after. But first, you may have heard we had a little election this week in Maryland. Democrats and Republicans chose their party nominees for governor, attorney general, comptroller, the U.S. House, every single seat in the General Assembly, as well as county executives, county councils, state's attorneys, sheriffs, and other offices. It would take too long for us to list them all. One thing was certain, millions of dollars were spent. Airwaves were full of ads. Mailboxes were full of mailers. But not a whole lot changed. The gubernatorial matchup will be the same as it was 4 years ago. All seven incumbents running for Congress won their party's nomination, with the only open seat going to the heavily backed and funded candidate, while the lone high-profile state leader facing a tough primary challenge still won. Mail-in ballots are still being counted, and that includes in Baltimore County, where Julian Jones leads the high-profile Democratic primary for county executive, but his closest competitor, Izzy Patoka, isn't ready to concede yet, though his chances of victory get slimmer by the hour, with the count still going on there. We'll forgo analysis of those races out of Baltimore County with our reporter John Lee this week, but you can guarantee that once the counting is done, John will be on our show talking about all the results and what they mean. Now to go over all the state races, we welcome in WYPR's State House and State Politics reporter, Sarah Petrowich. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Bill Ferguson is Maryland's Senate president, a post the Democrat has had for 6 years after taking over from Mike Miller, who is the longest serving Senate president, not just in Maryland history, but also U.S. history. Ferguson is looking to win another term representing the 46th district in the city of Baltimore, which includes Federal Hill, the Inner Harbor, Fells Point, and Patterson Park. But for the first time in his political career, he faced a viable primary challenger in Bobby LePin, better known on social media as Captain Bobby. We talked about the candidates before on the show. So what was the decision from Democratic voters in the 46th?
Yeah, the status quo will be maintained. Senate President Bill Ferguson won with almost 58% of the vote, so not quite a landslide, but pretty comfortable, defeating LePin by just over 1,500 votes. So that likely sets up Ferguson for another 4 years. He does have a Republican challenger, but that district is pretty safe Democratic.
Ferguson declared victory pretty early in the night on Tuesday. I believe it was before the AP called the race. But he had a lot to say to voters, and maybe why he declared victory so early, he wanted to talk.
Yeah, there was a little bit in a shift in Ferguson's victory speech. We've seen him throughout the campaign really talk about his experience. But whenever it was shaping up for him to be the victor, he really did say that this campaign has changed him. Here's what he had to say about that.
This campaign has humbled me. There are moments when I realized that people felt further away than I ever knew. Too few people knew what we had gotten done on their behalf. I've never been interested in the publicity or the performance. I wanted the work to speak for itself, but it does not. You have to show up. You have to explain it, and you have to earn it over and over.
Now, you were at Ferguson's election night party on Tuesday, but you did talk to Bobby LePin earlier in the day. What did he have to say to you?
Yeah, I met up with Bobby at a polling precinct, and we sat on a stoop, talked for about 10 minutes, and I gave him both scenarios. You know, I asked him what he would do if he won, and I also asked him what he would do if he lost, although he was pretty confident that he was going to win this race at this time. It was about an hour before the polls closed, but here's what he said he would do if he lost the election.
I'll probably just go back to the boat business. I don't know. I really have no clue. All I know is I don't ever want to stop being part of this movement. You know, since 2014, I was the same guy when I first ran in 2014. I was this crazy progressive that, You know, people used to say, do you know, he's a democratic socialist. And now people are like, hey, he's a democratic socialist.
Yeah, and we'll talk more about that DSA alignment in a minute.
Yeah, right, but we'd want to get to this first, and that's Le Pen won 40% of the, or so of the vote in the 46th. All those people voted for him, again, as you said, as long as the election in the fall goes as we predict that Ferguson will win, all those voters for Le Pen will remain Ferguson constituents. So what did the victor have to say to them?
Yeah, this race was pretty interesting in that Bobby was positioning himself as a more progressive candidate, but Bill Ferguson has never really said that he's not a progressive. We'll also talk about that a little bit more. But whenever, after his victory speech, he did talk to some reporters, and we asked him what he had to say to those voters who voted for Bobby, who wanted a more progressive candidate over him, and here's what Ferguson had to say.
I will work every single day to win your confidence back and to make sure that... the next time around that we're in this place, that their opinions and voices are as important as anyone else, and I'm deeply thankful for their continued engagement, because we need everyone in this moment where democracy's on the line.
And this was a pretty interesting point, because throughout this campaign, Ferguson was really being criticized about his voting record in the General Assembly on not being progressive enough. So this will really be a turning point now that Ferguson is likely going to re-enter his term, to see if he really does take a more progressive stance and if anything has really shifted after facing this tough primary.
Now, we saw Democratic Socialists score some very big wins in New York City over some longtime incumbents on Tuesday in congressional races. There was no one really running with that banner here in Maryland, at least in the Baltimore area. But the 46th race, which we've been talking about here, was one where he had an established Democrat, Bill Ferguson, as we're talking about, running against someone who was at least considered or perceived as more progressive than him. Now, was Le Pen actually more progressive than Ferguson, and was he actually DSA?
Yeah, this is a great question. I talked to both candidates a couple weeks before the election, and when I sat down with Ferguson, I actually asked him straight up, do you think that Bobby Le Pen is a more progressive candidate than you? Because whenever Bill Ferguson ran 16 years ago, he positioned himself as a more progressive Democrat, the incumbent at that time. And he really kind of skirted that question. He said that he didn't want to talk about the labels. It's for the voters to decide who's best to serve the 46th. And when it came down to it, he really said that it's all about, quote, demonstrated leadership that is bringing home and delivering for the city of Maryland, or if voters want, quote, something else. So he really kind of avoided that. As for Le Pen, kind of a similar story, honestly. When I talked to him about his stances, he really tried to push the more I'm a progressive Democrat. But right here, hours before the polls closed, we heard him really talk about saying affirmatively that he is a Democratic Socialist. When I pressed him on it more, he at least positions himself as DSA aligned, so not necessarily a card-carrying member, but this does show this shift towards candidates being more comfortable announcing themselves as socialists, even though this didn't go the way that Bobby was hoping for.
True. Had the New York election maybe taken a week beforehand, he may have been a little more open about the DSA part, as I think a lot of candidates may be now. Now, two incumbents in the city of Baltimore's State House delegation did lose this week. Who were they?
Yes, we've got Dahlia Attar, who represented Western Baltimore in the House of Delegates for 6 years before being appointed to fill a vacancy in the state Senate by Governor Westmore in 2025. But Attar's political career took a pretty big hit in October when her brother, and a Baltimore police officer were indicted on federal extortion charges. So this time around, Governor Moore backed current House delegate Malcolm Ruff, who represents the same area, in the Democratic primary, and Ruff defeated Attar with 60% of the vote. And then we've got Frank Conaway Jr. He's represented the Druid Hill Park area for 20 years in the House of Delegates, but his term will come to an end after internet gaming interests spent tens of thousands of dollars in opposition of his campaign. Conaway introduced a bill this year that would have expanded efforts against illegal gambling in Maryland, but it did not make it through the legislature. Regardless, he only secured 10% of the vote, and community activist Tiffany Welch is on track to take his seat in the three-person delegation. And then finally, Senate Majority Leader Nancy King and Republican Delegate Kevin Hornberger were also likely unseated. And there's some other close races as we wait for the final mail-in ballot totals.
There's still thousands of mail-in ballots to be counted. And the election isn't certified until, I believe, July 7th it's about 10 days or so. So we still have a lot to look forward to there. One thing looking forward to the fall now is that the race at the top of the ticket's going to look exactly the same as it did 4 years ago. Democratic Governor Wes Moore is looking to get a second term in office against Republican Dan Cox in 2022. Moore defeated Cox by 32%, more than doubling Cox's vote total. Now, after Tuesday, what did the candidates say after winning their party's nominations, and how does what they're saying set up the fall election?
Yeah, like you said, Moore pretty much won in a landslide against his token opposition, Eric Felber, with nearly 88% of the vote. In a statement, Moore said that he and his Lieutenant Governor Aruna Miller are seeking a second term to continue the progress they've made throughout Maryland. So in his statement, he really focused on continuing to grow the economy, drive down crime, and invest more in public schools. Ironically enough, though, this is what his opposition, Dan Cox, the Republican nominee, as we said, setting up for this rematch, really pointed to as failures on Moore's part, which he says Maryland is, quote, too dangerous, too expensive, and too unaccountable. He called on all Democrats, independents, and Republicans to, quote, unite with purpose to save our state and place it back on the path of safety and opportunity for all. So these candidates really couldn't be more diametrically opposed. Also, one more point we're going to be looking for is to see if President Trump endorses Dan Cox. He did endorse him the first time around. Cox is very Trump aligned. He's a big supporter, but he did lose before. And we know that President Trump does not like losers. So we'll be keeping an eye out for that endorsement.
Something else voters in Maryland could decide this fall, a state constitutional amendment on congressional redistricting. Now, there are already going to be a couple other amendments on the ballot already, but this one, should it get there, would be in response to the national push by Democrats and Republicans to redraw maps to favor their party. A special session of the General Assembly must happen first. What's the latest with all that? Are you packing your bags again for Annapolis next month?
It sounds like that way this summer. I will be back at the State House. So, yes, if you've been following this nationwide redistricting arms race, Maryland was poised to potentially enter that race. This is not a full-fledged map, though. What a lot of state Democrats are looking to do is redraw Maryland's congressional map to be 8-0 in favor of Democrats. Currently, the split is 7-1. But Senate President Bill Ferguson, who we've been talking about, he's been the primary opponent of that map, and he believes it's because it would not stand a legal challenge. So in order to fix that, he wants to pass a constitutional amendment that would change some language around political gerrymandering. So yes, he is now in favor of calling a special session. We don't have a date yet. It's likely to be mid-July to change that constitutional that provision in the Constitution. If the legislature approves it, it would then go to voters in November, and it'll be up to Marylanders to decide.
Sarah Petrowicz is WIPR's State House and State Politics reporter. Make sure you stay with us throughout the summer, because it looks like we're going to have some more news coming from Sarah out of Annapolis. Thanks so much for joining us.
Absolutely. It's going to be interesting. Take care.
Coming up next, we talk about money and power in Maryland's 5th and 6th congressional district races. I'm Matt Bush, and this is WIPR's Friday News Roundup. Stay with us after this short break.
Baltimore Public Media brings a double dose of Sunday morning tunes to the Maryland State Fair September 13th. First, it's Pop Princesses with Enzlo at 11:30. Pitch perfect hits from Taylor, Olivia Rodrigo, Sabrina Carpenter, and many more. Then at 2:30, it's a K-pop dance party from BTS to Demon Hunters with singers backed by a 10-person dance troupe. Dress your best for both September 13th. Tickets on sale now include fair admission. Details at WTMD.org.
Maryland Unfolded is a new history podcast from Baltimore Public Media and WYPR. On the latest episode, we discuss Maryland politics during the Revolutionary War and former poet laureate Lucille Clifton. Maryland Unfolded, available the first and third Thursdays of each month at WYPR.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Made possible, in part, by Gallagher LLP.
A connection between religious faith and aliens may sound like good fiction, but it turns out religious leaders have been seriously exploring the possibility of alien life for some time. We'll hear that story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered, happening this afternoon at 4 here on WIPR, Baltimore's NPR news station and proud partner with the nonprofit news site, The Baltimore Banner. Together, WIPR and The Banner are bringing local news you can trust to Maryland. Learn more at thebanner.com.
And welcome back to WIPR's News Roundup, our weekly show examining some of the big issues facing Baltimore, the region, and Maryland. This week, we continue our coverage of Tuesday's primary election results across Maryland. We're going to head to the 5th and 6th congressional districts, two races with local and national significance. And one of them may have been the most expensive U.S. House primary campaign in U.S. history. And despite all that money, very little's changed. We have WIPR's Nathaniel Miller joining us in studio. Welcome back, Nathaniel.
Thank you for having me.
And William J. Brown will also join us, too. He's a political reporter for Maryland Matters. He was just on our show last week. We're going to start with you, Nathaniel, out in the 6th District, which is takes the western panhandle of Maryland, but also the upper part of Montgomery County, including Germantown is in that district. $33 million was spent by two candidates out there, the incumbent April McLean Delaney and the person she replaced in that office, Democrat David Trone. They're running for the Democratic Party nomination. Delaney won. She attributed that victory to the campaign that she ran.
You know, it did devolve into a very negative campaign by my opponent, and I answered back trying to defend my reputation. But, you know, at the end, I just had enough. I said, no more negativity. I said, enough of this. This is who I am. This is who April is. And I got very positive responses from that.
Now, you were at Delaney's election night party. It was in Gaithersburg. How was it? And what was the reaction of her supporters?
So Delaney's supporters actually came out in force pretty early in the night and stayed strong all the way until closing. They remained anxiously optimistic as Delaney kept a 4% lead ahead of Trone for most of the evening. Now, once the Associated Press actually called the vote, it was immediate excitement, jumping and hollering just to spread the news around. People were just beginning to leave when they immediately turned around and headed straight for the bar. Quite a few celebratory drinks were had.
Right. The AP call came kind of late, around 11:30. We were actually beginning to wrap up ourselves as news coverage. Our freelancer, Michael Toscano, was at David Trone's party and already filed a story and then had to refile it after the AP call came. Now, Trone had endorsed Delaney in her first bid to be congresswoman 2 years ago. He ran for the Democratic nomination for Senate, losing to Angela Alsobrooks. How different were these candidates this time, 2 years later? It was one particular issue they were very different on, and it became the flashpoint in the campaign.
So they stood on opposite ends of the same side of the coin. Each claimed various accusations against the other person, but as you said, the flashpoint was immigration, particularly the Laken Riley Act. Now, the act itself allowed for undocumented immigrants to be indefinitely detained for the duration of their immigration case on arrest only. Other laws like that existed, but they required some kind of actual final decision. This was spurred on by an undocumented Venezuelan national sexually assaulting and killing Laken Riley, who was a college student. Delaney originally voted for the Laken Riley Act, but she says that was within the first few weeks of her time in office and points to 45 other Democrats who voted with her. Trone argues that he can barely recognize the woman he once supported, while Delaney says her immigration record is strong. Trone says Delaney didn't mention ICE or anything about it until he announced his bid.
And we said this was one of the most expensive, if not the most expensive, House primary in U.S. history. David Trone owns Total Wine and More. Delaney has a lot of PAC money, and her husband, John Delaney, who held the seat before David Trone did, also very rich. Now, you spoke with one voter ahead of the election, Amanda Tolbert, about all this, and she sounded very frustrated.
These people that have been in office forever have tons of money to spend, and young people don't. And I think there should be laws addressing that concern. I think there should be term limits, because if you don't have the money, you don't. There's no way you can do it. And it's sad.
So tell us about more of all this money that was spent.
So Delaney and Trone have net worths in the tens of millions. And between the two of them, as you said, spent $33 million. That means money for ads, publicity, and a whole lot more. The campaigns of all four remaining candidates didn't even breach $1 million in total. Trone, as you said, is the owner of Total Wine and More, Delaney backed by AIPAC and her husband's bank. The rest of the candidates just didn't have that kind of financial support.
And that voter, Amanda Tolbert, that you spoke with, was also frustrated with the candidates themselves in a couple of ways.
I'm Gen X, and I really, really would like to vote for more millennials and Gen Z. I'm tired of the same people running for office, and they probably have no idea what it's like for somebody to buy a house, somebody send their kid to daycare. I would vote for those young people just to get a change, because I think it's the same thing over and over and over again, which isn't giving us anything better.
On a night when many candidates were younger, or at least embracing some of the policies that younger voters appreciated, this is in the most expensive U.S. House primary possibly ever. Young candidates that ran out there just didn't have any space, did they?
No. See, according to the unofficial Maryland Board of Education elections count, Delaney and Trone held approximately 81% of the votes between them. That remaining 19% was split between four remaining candidates, and not one of them had more than 10% of the remaining votes. Montgomery County carried Delaney nearly 8,000 votes, followed by Frederick and Washington County with 6,000 and 3,000 votes, respectively. Alexis Goldstein was actually the only other candidate to get more than 1,000 votes in any county. According to NPR, nearly 80% of Democrats, Republicans, and independents want to see term and age limits set for congressional candidates.
Well, there was one congressional primary that was an open seat, and that was down in the 5th District in Southern Maryland. Congressman Steny Hoyer represented that seat for 45 years now. William J. Ford joins us now to discuss that. And in January, that seat's likely going to be taken by Adrian Boifo. He declared victory in the primary around 9:30 on election night. That's earlier than many other victorious candidates did, and none of them had 23 challengers. So, William, you covered this race. Is this how you expected things to go?
Now, when you have Steny Hoyer in your back, that helped. And what's interesting, what I heard about in terms of young people, well, Adrian Boifo is 32 years old. And he got elected. And assess a little bit. There were three of the top three opponents that were connecting him to AIPAC money, saying he's connected with Larry Ellison, the billionaire who co-founded Oracle. But there were some voters that didn't look at that because they chose Adrian Boifo. They said, well, we have somebody who's 32 years old. He can bring fresh new ideas, fresh perspectives, and have Steny Hoyer, who is one of the longest reigning members in all of Congress, 87, given his blessing. And you had Governor Wes Moore, had Senator Angela Alsobrooks also back in Boifo. And there were some voters who said, you know what? If they back him, so can I.
And ahead of the primary, we talked on the show about Maryland Senator Chris Van Hollen, one of the few that was not endorsing in this race. He talked about all the political action committee money that came funding Adrian Boifo, things that came from crypto and from pro-Israeli groups. Did Boifo address any of that in his victory speech, or were any voters even talking about that at all?
Well, there was a few voters that did talk about it. And in terms of his victory speech, actually, Steny Hoyer addressed in terms of how Delegate Boifo is for everyone and will be looking out to make sure that particular special interest groups do not basically just rig the system. Mm-hmm. But there's a few voters that say, well, wait a minute, if you're working for a group who, in terms of Oracle, who is co-founded by a billionaire, whose company is looking to build data centers, for example, where a lot of individual folks, especially progressive mindset individuals, they aren't for data centers at all because they say they ruin the environment, for example. So how does that carry over? But it worked. And there was one individual who was there. I don't want to say who it was because I didn't get permission to use this individual's name, but went and said, Steny Hoyer knows Maryland. He backed Governor Wes Moore, elected. He backed Senator Alsobrooks, elected. He backed Adrian Boifo, elected. For folks who may think an 87-year-old man don't have no play in Maryland, think again.
Well, Boifo was just one of a number of black candidates who won their elections in Maryland this week. Both of his parents immigrated from Ghana, a country that tied its World Cup match against England on the same day as the election, so Boifo and his family had even more to cheer for. There is a Republican candidate in the 5th in the fall, Chris Chafee, who Boifo will have to defeat, but he's going to be the heavy favorite going into the fall. Should other favorites who going into the fall win their elections as well, Maryland would have a black governor and a black attorney general. 40% of its congressional delegation would be black, and 5 of its 6 largest jurisdictions would have black leaders. Now, just last week, we were talking about black representation in Maryland and how the Supreme Court decision gutting the Voting Rights Act may affect it. But given all these victories by these candidates this time, what does that say about Maryland and the country at this particular time in history?
Well, I would say Maryland is a unique individual state. And let's step back and just assess this for a little bit. Some people outside look at Maryland as this big, progressive, just landscape of tranquility, diversity. Now, it is one of the top 5 diverse states in the country. But that population of heavy Democratic individuals, really in the Baltimore, D.C. areas, there's still a few conservatives out in the Eastern Shore and Western Maryland. Maryland's really in the middle of the pack. But in terms of the electorate, yeah, it says Maryland is one of those states that will be looked upon as if they can elect black leaders, which has a heavy African-American population. Why can't other places? But you got to look at the policies in those other states to assess if that will work. And if you start at the state level, which the Legislative Black Caucus of Maryland labels itself as the biggest black caucus in the country, definitely is by percentage. Now, folks in Georgia will have a little say, but won't get into that little nugget right now. It's a fun argument that the two legislative bodies have. But Maryland, what it has major leadership in places that helps make decisions. The House Speaker, Jocelyn Perry-Melnick. You have the Senate President Pro Tem, Malcolm Augustine, Senator Will Smith, who chairs the powerful Senate Judicial Proceedings Committee.
Unfortunately, we're going to have to kind of wrap it up here for a break. But William J. Ford from Maryland Matters, thank you again for joining us.
Thank you, sir.
And Nathaniel Miller covers Frederick for us here at WIPR.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be back after this short break. You're listening to the WIPR News Roundup. Stay with us.
You know why you listen to WIPR, because you want to stay informed about the world around you. You want reporting with depth and nuance, reporting that strives to offer all sides of any story. WIPR members make it possible. Without listener support, public radio couldn't afford to exist. Please do your part by making a new or additional tax-deductible donation. Go to WIPR.org, click the donate link, and thanks.
Baltimore Public Media brings a double dose of Sunday morning tunes to the Maryland State Fair September 13th. First, it's Pop Princesses with Enzlo at 11:30. Pitch perfect hits from Taylor, Olivia Rodrigo, Sabrina Carpenter, and many more. Then at 2:30, it's a K-pop dance party from BTS to Demon Hunters with singers backed by a 10-person dance troupe. Dress your best for both September 13th. Tickets on sale now include fair admission. Details at WTMD.org.
Maryland Unfolded is a new history podcast from Baltimore Public Media and WYPR. On the latest episode, we discuss Maryland politics during the Revolutionary War and former poet laureate Lucille Clifton. Maryland Unfolded, available the first and third Thursdays of each month at WYPR.org or wherever you get your podcasts. Made possible, in part, by Gallagher LLP.
This is 88.1 WIPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
And good afternoon, and welcome back to WIPR's News Roundup. I'm Matt Bush, news director of the award-winning WIPR Newsroom. There is one more race we want to talk about. It took place in the city of Baltimore. This week, Mayor Brandon Scott sent out a message on Instagram. Good morning, Baltimore. There's a new sheriff in town. Announcing the election victory of Sabrina Tapp Harper, the city's first woman to lead the department. Tapp Harper was endorsed by Scott in that race. This particular election had a lot of history, and to help explain it to all of us, we have Emily Opilo with our news partners. The Baltimore Banner joining us on Zoom. Emily, thanks for coming in.
Hi there. Good to be there.
So you've been covering the city for a few years now, and Sheriff Sam Cogan has been the sheriff for the last 4 years. It looked like he would be unseated Tuesday night. He finally conceded on Thursday. I know that Mayor Scott was happy with the win. How has the rest of the city reacted to this? The sheriff put a lot of money into this election, but Tapp Harper did pull ahead. How'd she do it?
Yeah, it's. I think there's been some surprise. You know, I mean, if you are just sort of a casual observer here in the city watching elections, you might not have been expecting this outcome. But if you talked to Sabrina Tapp Harper's folks, you know, they were feeling very confident going in. And, you know, I think that's in part because they had the endorsement of Mayor Scott, who you mentioned. This was sort of a grudge match of sorts. Sheriff Cogan had endorsed Mayor Scott's opponent in the last mayoral race. That was Sheila Dixon. And so we were not surprised to see that Mayor Scott was backing Sabrina Tapp Harper this time, while a lot of other elected officials were backing Sheriff Cogan. And, you know, the two have butted heads previously, not just on that the endorsement issue, but also when Sheriff Cogan was attempting to get raises for his folks. Instead of, you know, waiting for those to happen, he had his folks file sort of questionable time cards, and it caused a huge overage in the city budget and caused an inspector general report. So it was not surprising to see the mayor backing someone else this time around.
Tell us a little bit about Tap Harper. I know she'd been with the Baltimore Police Department for 26 years. She's from East Baltimore. What else should we know?
Yeah, she's definitely an interesting person. She, in addition to the 26 years with the police department, where she really took an issue or took on the issue of sexual abuse, she has advanced during her time at the sheriff's office some domestic violence issues. That's something that the sheriff's office oversees, and that she definitely made that an issue on the campaign trail. We saw that a lot of that type of promises from her going forward. I think we're also going to see her promising to partner with the mayor going forward. She would like to get his Office of Homeless Services and more involved in the evictions that the sheriff's office is doing. And she's also pledged to get involved in some of his violence reduction efforts that we have seen recently that have led to or been a contributor to the reduction of homicides in the city.
Outgoing Sheriff Sam Cogan won his first campaign 4 years ago. When he won, Tab Harper was promoted to assistant sheriff. That didn't last long, though. What happened?
Yeah, this was a grudge match on a lot of different fronts. Both Tap Harper and Cogan worked for the city's longtime sheriff, John Anderson, who had the job for 30 years. And originally they were side by side, but there was already some animosity there. Before John Anderson left office, Tap Harper filed a discrimination suit against him, alleging race and gender discrimination. And one of the people included in her complaint was Sam Cogan. To resolve that case, Sheriff Anderson promoted Tap Harper in his final days in office, but he had already lost the race to Sam Cogan, and he was going to be handing over the reins to the office. And when Cogan took the office himself, he wanted a new leadership team under him, and he decided to put Ms. Tap Harper on leave at that point. And even though she announced plans to retire, he terminated her first. So then she filed a workplace discrimination case against Cogan. So I know it all sounds terribly complicated, but that case is still playing out. And it was playing out in the background of this election, which made it really interesting. Both sides were sitting for deposition as this campaign played out.
So many more things that were happening in this election, and looking forward to how the changes that Tab Harper will be making in the office when she assumes the office after this election. You can read that all from Emily Apilo's reporting in the Baltimore Banner. She covers City Hall. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for being here.
Next up, CL250 ships from around the world are floating right here in the Baltimore Harbor. Stay with us. This is the WYPR News Roundup.
Support for WYPR comes from the law firm of Gallagher LLP, a legal partner for businesses and nonprofits across Baltimore and the Mid-Atlantic for more than 60 years. More information at GallagherLLP.com.
Maryland's largest free outdoor concert series, WTMD's First Thursdays, returns to Canton Waterfront Park July 9th with Chicago's acclaimed Rat Boys, from Houston, the 20-something voice of Blessing Jolie, and Delaware's Fitzky Brothers. Add a boatload of local food and drink, artisans, crafters, and community organizations in the Vendor Village for Baltimore's best outdoor concert experience. More details at WTMD.org.
Hey, I'm Scott Massioni, the health reporter at WYPR. You know what really makes me sick? A lack of information. And you'll never get that when you're tuned in to WYPR. I'm covering everything from the latest flu trends to what doctors are struggling with each day. I even throw a fun story about the Orioles in on occasion, too. So please keep this amazing service alive and donate now at WYPR.org.
A connection between religious faith and aliens may sound like good fiction, but it turns out religious leaders have been seriously exploring the possibility of alien life for some time. We'll hear that story on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Coming up this afternoon and every weekday at 4 here on WIPR, Baltimore's NPR News Station at 88.1.
Welcome back to the WIPR News Roundup. I'm Matt Bush. If you're listening here in Baltimore City, you may have noticed, there's no way you couldn't, more air traffic than usual the past couple days. Well, today and yesterday, the Blue Angels, the British Red Arrows, and the French Air and Space Force are practicing a few aerial maneuvers in the Baltimore sky. It's all part of Sail 250. Baltimore Peninsula, Kenton Waterfront Park, and Fort McHenry are the official viewing areas, but you may spot something just by looking up or once you step outside. And as the name Sail 250 implies, along with the air show, visitors will be arriving by sea to help celebrate the 250th anniversary of the United States next week. Many of the ships are based here in the U.S., but there are also ships coming from Romania, Italy, India, Sweden, and many countries with a heavy contingent from South America. To talk to us about all this, Rich Shores, the Maritime Operations Manager for Sail 250 Baltimore. He's joining us now via Zoom. Rich, welcome to the show.
Hi, good to be here.
Now, Rich, all these ships, and they are ships, not boats, are really something to look at. They all have a history, too. They're not your typical backyard skiffs, and I understand some of them are also related. So break that all down for us.
That's correct. Yes, these are indeed ships, not boats. Some of them are barks, some are barkentines, some are full-rigged ships. You can look that up and get a good education on what exactly that means.
Yes, very briefly. What is the difference between a ship and boat?
So a full-rigged ship, and one example is the Libertad from Argentina. She is a full-rigged ship, meaning all of her masts carry square sails. Mm. Versus other ships that maybe two of the masts have the triangular sails that you might see on a pleasure boat. And then the foremast has the square rigged sail. So it's broken down by, you know, the square sails versus a triangular sail and a few other technical matters. But that's the basic breakdown of that.
Now, the flags on these ships have changed over the years, too. They're obviously, they have the ones that they have now. But a lot, these ships aren't static. They've changed quite a bit over the years, right?
They do change, and sometimes they change hands. To your point earlier, we have four ships in here that are sister ships, and that is the Gorsfok from Germany, the Romanian Mircea, the Sagres from Portugal, and our very own U.S. Coast Guard cutter Eagle. All of those ships were built in the Blumenvoss shipyard in the 1930s in Germany. After the war, after World War II, they were taken as war reparations. From Germany. The Russians took the Mircea. It eventually came back to Romania. We got the Eagle.
We're having some Zoom issues right now. We're talking to Rich Shores. He's the Maritime Operations Manager for Sail Baltimore and Sail 250 Maryland. That's taking place right now down in the Inner Harbor. Best places you can view the ships right now as they're coming in. And again, as Rich told us, they are ships, not boats. Go to the Baltimore Peninsula, the Kent Waterfront Park, and Fort McHenry. Rich, again, if we can get back to you. Some of these ships are coming in from a really, really long place. Some come from Romania. They're starting in the Black Sea, then getting through the Mediterranean and then the Atlantic Ocean. The Indian ship also had a very, very long trip. Can you tell us how long some of these voyages take? And we still have kind of lost Rich, I guess, unfortunately, on the Zoom here. So you're listening to the WYPR News Roundup. I'm Matt Bush. We're talking about Sail 250. That is the event that's taking place right now downtown in the Inner Harbor, but it's stretching all the way down to Fort McHenry. He's now on the phone. Rich, thank you.
Yes.
Thank you for this. Just talk about how long some of these ships that have arrived here, how long their voyages have been to get here.
Sure. So most of the ships have come up from Norfolk, so that's not that far. But this is part of a five-city event, and that event started in New Orleans. We had Sail 250 New Orleans, then Norfolk, then Baltimore, New York, Boston. So they've sailed at least as far as New Orleans. However, some of these ships have come from much further away and directly to us. So the Amerigo Vespucci from Italy, she came in from Europe. So she did make a stop, I think, in Bermuda on the way, but that's a long voyage. That's much further than just Norfolk up to here, obviously, which is, you know, an overnight trip. The Sudarshini is from India, and she traveled a long way. So she was built in Goa on the west coast, and I believe her actual port is further south in India. So she's the ship that's traveled the farthest to get here. So we have, you know, quite a contingent that have come to celebrate our birthday with us.
So for those going down to look at these ships, and I've seen some of them as I've been driving around the harbor, and they're quite impressive. What are some of the great places within the area down there where this is taking place for people to look at these ships, both up close and from far away?
Oh, sure. Well, Federal Hill, probably no surprise, right? We'll have a fantastic view from up top with the whole panorama of the harbor, from the west wall of the inner harbor along every single pier. We have ships on Pier 1, Pier 3, Pier 4, Pier 5, Pier 6, loaded with vessels. We have all of the sister ships, in fact, at Pier 6, Pier 5, and Pier 4 right next to each other. We have ships up in the slips in between those piers, but that is a great panoramic view, I would think, from Federal Hill. But really, anywhere around the harbor, you can get some amazing photographs, glimpses between the buildings with the ship's masts and their lines, you know, rigged with flags. It's really a beautiful sight. From Fells Point, you can look across at Tide Point and see three of the biggest ships in Tide Point, or from Tide Point, you can look across to Fells Point and see our very own Pride of Baltimore II and the Canadian warship that's in there. I don't want to leave out Baltimore Peninsula. We have two massive U.S. Navy ships over there, the Marinette and the Arlington. The Arlington is an LPD. This is the ship that they use to go and retrieve a space capsule when it splashes in the ocean. So this thing goes out there. It can kind of open its bay, flood the bay, sink a little bit, and take on other vessels inside of it. That's how big it is.
That's really, really impressive. Well, for everyone who wants to go see it again, that's taking place this weekend. Rich just gave you a great description of all the various places that you can go and view these ships. Rich Shores, he is the Maritime Operations Manager for Sail Baltimore and Sail 250 Maryland. Check out the ships and sailors through Monday. Thanks so much for coming on today.
Thanks for having me on. I hope everybody comes down. It's a great event. We're lucky to have it.
Absolutely. Also, some events going on this weekend. Protests against militarism planned by Veterans for Peace in and around Baltimore and in Washington, D.C. And the Morgan State University Choir is slated to join thousands of others for an Alternative America 250 event. And there'll be communities marching down in Washington, D.C., with a march beginning at 2 o'clock this weekend through D.C.'s Black Lives Matter Plaza and past the White House. Or that's going on in D.C. Up next, though, we're going to be talking about Pride Month as it's coming to an end. We check in on one Baltimore party where a lot of the fun has been happening this month. Stay with us after this break. You're listening to the WIPR News Roundup.
Is classical music just not for you? Well, maybe it's time to be classical curious. Join us Saturday, June 27th at Maryland Hall in Annapolis as WIPR and the Columbia Orchestra present classical music for people with short attention spans, an engaging, humorous, fast-paced concert experience. For both newcomers and seasoned listeners, enjoy a lively program of short works from across the classical repertoire hosted by WIPR's Taylor Holbrooks. Two shows, 11 a.m. and 1 p.m. Tickets and more info at WIPR.org.
Baltimore Public Media's New Next Film Festival welcomes Oscar-nominated filmmaker Deborah Granick of Winter's Bone and Leave No Trace to the Charles Theater for a special screening of episodes of her new documentary series, Con Body vs. Everybody, on Monday, July 15th. She'll be joined by WIPR's Erica Kane for a conversation about the nonfiction series' insights to building community and breaking the cycle of recidivism. Tickets and more info at WIPR.org.
The thing you need to know is I didn't graduate college till I was 36. And when I went to seminary, I was so old that they called me a second career student, which I thought was adorable because it implied I had a first career.
Join us for more true stories told live. From pastors and cotton candy to a revolutionary bike ride. That's on the Moth Radio Hour from PRX.
You can listen to the Moth Radio Hour every Saturday at 2 here on WIPR, Baltimore's NPR news station.
And welcome back to the WIPR News Roundup. I'm Matt Bush, closing out the show this week, talking about Pride Month, which is coming to a close here in Baltimore, but that doesn't mean the party is over. Butch Garden, a monthly queer dance party, is celebrating half a decade here in Baltimore, and its founders, Amy Reed and Pangelica Hall, join us now in studio to talk about what it takes to create a more accessible and community-oriented dance party. Amy and Pangelica, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thanks for having us.
So tell us about Butch Garden. For those who haven't been, what's the experience like? What should they know getting into this?
So Butch Garden is our seasonal day party that we have. It's a queer happy hour, and it happens at Peabody Heights Brewery from 4 to 9 every first Saturday. And basically, it's centered around community. We have DJs play the entire time. Up until now, it's been mostly me and Amy playing, but now we've been able to bring in more DJs to play. So we're super excited about that. And it's an intergenerational party. So you'll see all ages from little toddlers to the older gays, which is really super fun. And it's just a real fun time. Starts out kind of slow, but then by the end of the night, it's real festival vibes and tons of people, a sea of people.
So one thing you already mentioned is that this is an intergenerational space. The dance floor is people of all ages and all generations. So how do you cultivate something like this? And how do you cultivate it as a queer space too?
I think a lot has to do with the time and it being a day party. That opens the doors for both young folks, middle-aged folks, older folks, elders to come out. I feel like as a person that is also getting older, I don't want to be out till 3 a.m. all the time. So it's nice to, you know, we start the night and then you can either go home or you can go to another party after that. And I think it's we're something that we're really proud of and really important to us because there's not a lot of spaces for intergenerational folks to interact and learn from each other and be around each other, have conversations.
You both DJ. How do you build the playlist? Because if there's anything generations love to fight over.
Oh, that is, that is a very controversial thing over at Butch Garden. So in the beginning, like when we first started at 4, we kind of like to play chiller things. Mm-hmm. And I'm getting used to playing things for the older queers than playing like the classic top 40s from like the 80s, 90s and the early 2000s. But we also like to keep the vibe kind of chill so people can still talk and mingle. A lot of people come early for that. Point alone just to talk and mingle. And then as the night goes on, that's when we get a little more experimental and start to get more dancey. And the dance floor really builds up over the entire event. And by the end of it, it's just like you can barely even move through and we're just going all the way.
Dan and I always talk about how where, you know, we'll be DJing and we'll be looking down and then we look up and then the crowd's grown times two. And we look down and then we look up again and then it grows times four. And we're like, what is happening?
And shout out to the babies of Butch Garden because when they come, they hop right on stage and they do crowd management and they hype up the crowd and everything.
That's great. Now, your partnership is called Girl Power and it aims to elevate LGBTQIA+ individuals here in the DMV. How did Girl Power and Butch Garden get its start? Was there a gap in the nightlife scene that you guys were trying to fill?
Yeah, so I can start off with the formation of Girl Power. We formed in 2014, and originally it was just me. And I was really inspired by some programming at the Crown, RIP. And I saw a gap in just women, queer people, specifically DJing and electronic music when there's so much of us out there. So the first one was at the Crown, both rooms, and it was awesome. And then my friend introduced me to Pangelica, and it became something that I really needed help with. And I'm really thankful that Pangelica came into the picture.
Yeah, and fun fact, I went to school in Chicago. I'm from here, but when I moved back, I wanted to play music. So Girl Power was one of my first live shows that I've ever done. But it started out more curatorial and more based off of live performances from both performance artists and musicians. And then it kind of grew to be something that's more focused on community and connection and cultivating community together. And I think the focus has kind of went away from the performance, but we're still down to do that as well.
For sure.
As part of your mission is cultivating queer joy. Tell us how you do that. Tell us about why that was something that you were looking to do.
I think now more than ever, it's mm-hmm. something that's really important when, news is kind of bleak and there's active legislation against queer people. And so I think visibility is really important. And something we talk a lot about is just being authentic and how not everyone feels like every space is like safe to express themselves via gender, sexual orientation, what have you. And so I think that we offer that space where people can come as they are. You can come in gym shorts and a bra. You can come in fishnets. Like, it doesn't matter. No one cares. Like, people are just excited to see. I am excited to see people like as they are.
Yeah. Cultivating community. Definitely. I've seen the fruits of that labor with Butch Garden to the point where I feel like the community owns Butch Garden more than
we do.
And like, we kind of like, we are like, we kind of work for them at this point. But like the whole queer joy there, like certain moments that you only get when, kind of like in these type of gatherings where the air is just electric and people are just free to be who they are. They feel some type of ownership of their space and some autonomy, and they feel power. And that's like all about what girl power is about. We're about empowerment and empowering the community.
Was there kind of a moment you understood that's where it was, where you said now the community kind of owns it, isn't just us running it? Like, was there a moment where you kind of felt that? Because I think a lot of people... they want to know that, they want to feel it, but they also maybe don't quite realize it, and they want to realize in their own lives and all the things they're doing. So kind of what was that moment for you all when you realized, like, I think the community now really runs this, not us?
Well, let me tell you something. Butch Garden, our audience is very vocal, and actually they've made us better for it. Like, we've become more accessible for it. Like, a good example is Butch Garden is a huge event, and it might start out slow, but by the end of the night, there's like 500, 600 people at Peabody Heights Brewery. And one person suggested, like, you know, this is overstimulating. Why don't you have like a cool down room? And we're like, what? We never did that before. And then we're like, actually, no, we can do that. And then when we did it, we're like, this is nice. But yeah, like, our audience is super, super vocal. And we do take that feedback, and it makes us better. And I think it helps the overall community, especially like other shows as well.
For sure. And I think this year specifically kind of like marked a turning point. Like, it's continued to grow. But this year, I mean, usually, like, the first one is explosive, and then, you know, the ones in between are kind of, like, still, like, 300 people well-attended. But now it's kind of consistently hundreds and hundreds of people. So I think just seeing the numbers is like, wow, this has become something other than, like, a little neighborhood queer get-together than how it started.
Yeah, and it's become regional. Like, it's not just Baltimore, but people come from Philly, New York, D.C. So it's really interesting.
Amy Reed and Pangelica Hall are the founders of Butch Garden. Their next one is coming up next Saturday, the 4th of July, at Peabody Heights Brewing. Amy's going to be one of the DJs. Don't miss it. Thank you so much for coming on the show. Much appreciated.
Thank you so much.
Next week, our show will be all about the 250th for the 4th of July. I'm Matt Bush, the news director of WIPR. Isaac Moss and Elizabeth Nonemaker helped us with production today. Shania Mapson and Sean Murphy are our studio engineers. And Amy Walters is our executive producer. Thank you so much for listening. Have a great weekend.